unions. We're talking here AFL-CIO, SEIU, American Federation of Teachers. You know what I'm talking about. Unions pulled out all the stops to get President Joe Biden elected in 2020. And so far, President Biden has given them love right back. Here he is last month honoring unions on Labor Day.
On Labor Day, we honor the dignity of the American worker. And every day, we remember that America wasn't built by Wall Street. They're not all bad folks on Wall Street. I'm not suggesting that. But they didn't build America. It was built by the middle class. And unions built the middle class.
Well, labor is having a moment right now.
Hold that line. UAW
74! We're willing to stay out here one day longer, one day stronger, however long it takes, but we are willing to negotiate with the company whenever they're ready to talk.
In October, workers at John Deere, Kellogg, and Kaiser Permanente have all gone on strike. And according to Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations, there have been close to 180 labor strikes so far this year. Here's what Chris Larson, an employee at John Deere for 19 years, told Democracy Now! About why they are striking.
What we're asking for is a fair shake and something equitable. I'd like to quote Walter Reuther here. We don't want a bigger slice of pie, we want a bigger pie.
For more on this, I spoke with Stephen Greenhouse, former New York Times labor reporter and author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor.
We're seeing lots of turbulence, tumult right now. We're seeing a series of strikes, a big wave of strikes. Over 10,000 workers have walked out at 14 John Deere factories. We're seeing a strike at Kellogg's in four different states. 1,400 workers have walked out. There's a long-running coal strike in Alabama. Nurses walked out at a hospital in Buffalo. There's a very long strike at a hospital in Worcester, Massachusetts. And then 24,000 nurses for Kaiser Permanente have voted to authorize a strike if they don't get what they want in negotiations. So there's a lot going on in labor. And I think a lot of workers are fed up. They feel they worked extremely hard. They gave their all during the pandemic. And then their employers come back and offer them mediocre to lousy contract offers. And they say, what's going on? We gave, we did our all, we increased your profits. And why are you offering us such a measly deal? That's on the union side, Melissa. On the non-union side, you know, we're just seeing a lot of workers exasperated, frustrated, fed up. As one economist described it, it's a take this job and shove it economy. They say, we risk our lives during the pandemic while you well-paid white-collar workers worked at home. We blue-collar workers, we frontline workers, busted our derrieres, busted our humps, risk getting COVID. And now you're just offering us measly raises and still forcing us to work tons of overtime. And we're going to look for better jobs, better paying jobs elsewhere. So that's why there's been this so-called great resignation. I might call it the great exodus from jobs. You know, more people are voluntarily quitting their jobs than any time in the last two decades. And that's because many people have reassessed their jobs during the pandemic, reassessed their lives and their work-family balance and say, something's broken, I want something better. And I'm not just ready to walk, but I'm walking to look for a better job.
Let's start with non-unionized workers, where we're seeing, you know, if you're looking at the data, right? So if you've got this sort of 10,000 foot perspective, you can see all of these individual workers in individual households in different cities and communities, right, making this choice to exit and to find other kinds of work. Now, is that just happening sort of individual by individual? Or is there actually, even for those who are not unionized, is there a collective conversation happening somewhere? Or is it really just like a trend that we're seeing? I'm trying to understand what those data tell us about how workers are making that decision. And then we'll come to the unions themselves.
I saw that Lane Wyndham, a labor expert at Georgetown, called it a general strike by non-union workers. I think that's an overstatement. But I think a lot of non-union workers read that other non-union workers are really dissatisfied and they're walking, they're voluntary quitting, they're exiting. And they're saying, maybe I shouldn't put up with this $9 or $10 an hour fast food job when I could get a job at Amazon for $15. People, you know, have opened their eyes. I think the pandemic has forced a lot of people to really open their eyes and see, hey, I'm not really being treated well at work. You know, I'm getting paid only $10 an hour. Some weeks they only have me working 12 hours. Other weeks they force me to work 10 hours overtime involuntarily. And after several decades in which things in many ways have gotten worse and worse for American workers, stagnant wages, health benefits have gotten worse, retirement benefits have gotten worse. And now that the pandemic is receding and now that many employers are reopening and are desperate to hire people, workers say, we have an opportunity. We have more power than before. And I think non-union workers, it's kind of contagious. They see this happening. They see reports on TV, on radio, and say, I could exercise more power. I could leave my job. I could tell my boss, if you don't give me a $3 an hour raise, I'm going to leave my job. And a big question now is whether this will lead to a more long-term improvement in wages and how workers are treated.
In this mass exodus, are we also seeing mass organizing? I'm wondering for non-union workers, if we're seeing a move towards towards unionization, towards other kinds of collective bargaining, so that some of it doesn't have to be simply an exodus, but could actually be about a shift of cultures, of practices, and of pay.
Melissa, thanks for clarifying this point. Many workers are happy, especially white-collar workers who could work at home safely, away from COVID, you know, not having to commute two hours a day. But it's the frontline workers, the essential workers, the blue-collar workers, the fast food workers, the factory workers, the meatpacking workers. They're much more disgruntled. They're much more fed up. They're much more ready to leave. Is this translating into more organizing? In the biggest unionization victory of the year, 3,000 professors at the University of Pittsburgh have voted to unionize, 71% to 29%. That's a big victory for labor. I'm sure many of your listeners have read about the effort to unionize Starbucks in Buffalo. That's the most sophisticated effort to unionize a Starbucks in the country. There are nearly 6,000 Starbucks in the nation right now, not a single corporate-owned Starbucks in the nation, not a single one is unionized.
Okay, so now let's talk about workers who are unionized in this moment and who are striking, not just in a general strike way, but who are making that choice to strike. What's going on and how are those companies responding?
So I worked on a story about this, and I interviewed a striker at John Deere. I interviewed a striker at Kellogg, and they both used the exact same phrase. I asked them, how do you feel about the company's offer? And they both said, it's a slap in the face. Hmm. And at both Kellogg's and at John Deere, workers worked a lot of overtime during the pandemic because there was great demand for their products. Meanwhile, profits at those companies are way up. The CEOs are paying themselves, $15 million, $20 million a year. And the workers at Deere, the workers at Kellogg, you know, see that there's a labor shortage now. They see the companies are desperate to hire. They realize, hey, if we walk out, it's not going to be easy for the company to find replacement workers to weaken our strike. And I think both Kellogg and Deere they didn't get the memo that, hey, the world has changed. Hey, you know, millions of American workers, you know, busted their hump, worked very hard, gave their all, risked their lives during the pandemic, and it's time for employers to treat their workers better. And a lot of employers are treating their workers better and are giving raises, and they're not the ones facing strikes. At Deere, at Kellogg, they're both insisting on two-tier contracts. And a lot of these workers are saying, what about the future of our children? If there's a two-tier contract, our children are going to end up with a much worse wages, much worse working conditions than we have. So they're fighting, these workers at Deere and at Kellogg are fighting to maintain standards. They don't want wages and working conditions going backwards, especially after they worked so hard during the pandemic and after they've been called, quote, essential, unquote, workers.
So you've been talking about this pandemic moment as a turning point for so much in how both American workers understand themselves as essential, understand where they connect. Are there any historical parallels? Are there moments in our history where similarly there seemed to be this sort of great awakening of laborers understanding, hey, wait a minute, we may have a lot more power in this system than it initially seems?
Great question. So historians will point out that 1919, the year after the First World War, and 1946, the year after the Second World War ended, had the biggest strike waves in American history. It was the great reassessment, the great rethinking of my jobs after having served in a war, and is this what I want, and can't I do better? And there is kind of this great reassessment going on now. We've been through this, you know, hellish year, this hellish 18 months, where a lot of workers, you know, worked at home. They saw their job, that, you know, their lives on the line when they were working in supermarkets or at fast food places or in meatpacking plants or in factories. And it's made them rethink, you know, is it worth my doing this? Is it worth working 70 hours and hardly seeing my kids during the week? Is it worth working for $10, $11 an hour? So I think this big historical, ugly historical development, the pandemic, is making people rethink, you know, their jobs, whether they like their jobs enough, whether they think their jobs are so bad that they should look elsewhere, whether the life-family balance in their jobs is so bad that it's time to look elsewhere.
All right. I want to talk about the politics of this a little bit. So when you look at the Democratic Party, union households remain among the most staunch supporters and most likely voters for the Democratic Party. And unions remain a really great way to just sort of organize the vote, right? It's basically black churches and union meetings if you want to get out that Democratic Party vote. So what are we going to see, or what do you suspect we might see from, or are already seeing, not only from DC lawmakers, but I'm thinking here specifically of Democrats in states and maybe Democrats in states where you don't have a lot of union activity, but now suddenly there's this kind of labor boiling. Is it possible for lawmakers to either shut this all down or really expand this in ways that allow for workers to really move forward politically as well as economically?
Joe Biden is the most pro-union president since FDR. Some people say even more pro-union. He's made extremely pro-union statements more than anything FDR said, where, you know, he kind of backed the unionization effort at Amazon. He talks about the importance of more workers unionizing to create a fairer economy and to lift workers. But he's reluctant to put his thumb on the scale during a strike. He said the strike at Deere is a righteous strike, but he's not ready to say, I support the workers in this strike. But I think workers do feel emboldened because there is this pro-union president. And Biden, much more than Barack Obama, much more than Bill Clinton, much more than Jimmy Carter, sees that having strong unions is important, one, to create a fair economy, two, to help lift workers' wages and reduce wage stagnation. And third, for political reasons, stronger unions are important to help the Democrats for fairness, for the good of the economy, and for politics, and for protecting our democracy to help unions grow. I think that's why Biden, you know, is trying very hard to help unions and to help blue-collar workers. His efforts to make childcare more affordable, his push to make community college free. You know, a lot of blue collar workers can hardly afford to send their kids to college, even community college. So Biden had this great idea to make community college free. I worry that's going to be deleted from his plan. You know, the $300 a month child care tax credit, that's to help blue collar families. It might not mean much for people earning $500,000 a year, but it'll mean a lot for blue collar families, frontline workers who make $50,000 or $30,000 a year. And Biden's infrastructure plan, that's to create hundreds of thousands of good middle class, and Biden always says union jobs, because he wants to strengthen the working class, strengthen blue collar America. And I'm sure he has in mind, if I do all those things, I'll make a lot of workers in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Minnesota and Iowa and Ohio happy. And that's not just good for society and good for our economy, but it will help the Democrats politically.
Stephen Greenhouse is a former New York Times labor reporter and the author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure and an honor. Thanks so much.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.